You're listening to a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find other episodes of The View and to subscribe to this podcast, visit questformeaning.org/VUU.
Hi, everybody. I'm Tom Shade, and I'm sitting in for the illustrious Meg Riley as the host of The View this week. So welcome, everyone, to The View, this online talk show by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. Let's go around and introduce ourselves, our regulars, real quickly here for it, and then we'll come back for maybe a little bit more check-in. I'm Tom Shade, and I'm a retired minister in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Who's next?
Hi, I'm Joanna Fontaine Crawford. I am in Austin, Texas.
And I'm Aisha Hauser, and I'm in Seattle, Washington.
I'm Bob LaValle, and I'm in Buffalo, New York.
And our guest this morning is going to be Dr. Susan Newman Moore, who is the acting senior minister at All Souls Church in Washington, D.C. She's also the associate minister for pastoral care there, but is the acting senior minister while the Reverend Rob Hardies is on sabbatical.
This is Susan Newman Moore from All Souls in Washington. You know, the whole experience of worship last Sunday after Prince's death was very powerful at All Souls. Our choir and our musicians were all, ready playing, and we decided that during the period of time when we all walk around and greet each other and hug each other and welcome each other, usually the band plays something. And our guitarist, David Cole, played Purple Rain. And Reverend Rebecca Parker, who's our theologian in residence also while Rob is on sabbatical, she had on her black robe and purple stole. I had on my white robe and purple with purple chevrons and purples down the front. And when I got back up in the pulpit, we all started waving our hands. And the whole church, 800 people singing Purple Rain. The guitarist was doing the solo. He was doing the damn thing, I'm telling you. And it was just awesome. And if you go on my Facebook page, you'll see it. And because it was like, it's sort of like what Jimmy Fallon said at Saturday Night Live. He was like an icon, like a Marilyn Monroe or Woody Guthrie. And he said, and who has their own color? Purple. He had his own color. And it was just something, it was something different about Prince. Unlike Michael Jackson, Prince, it was just something very spiritual in there. Michael was spiritual, but it was just something about that with Prince. And when I got up to speak for the first time in the pulpit, what I said was, "Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to get through this thing called life." Mm-hmm. Okay, that's the call to worship I have, So it was just powerful. So I like to hear the fact of what you shared about your time in New Orleans. And that's the kind of thing I love about being in the Unitarian Universalist Church, because we can sing Purple Rain at the 11:15 service.
I wonder how many. This is Meg Riley here in Minneapolis. Actually, I'm in St. Paul right now, but Prince's hometown, and I wonder how many of us started our services that way. I bet hundreds and hundreds, not just of Unitarian Universalists, but all kinds of people, I'm betting. He had such a broad influence, and here in Minneapolis, the whole city is just grieving. I mean, we went out that night and, dance party all night downtown at First Avenue, and all the buildings and bridges were purple, and then the next day, Friday, we just put on purple to walk around, and it was amazing the diversity of people that I saw wearing purple, old people, young people, every race of people, every gender of people. I mean, he touched everybody in such personal ways. It really, and I see some people like on Facebook going, why didn't David Bowie get this? Or why didn't Michael Jackson get this? And it's like, I think that word iconic, I mean, he was just so quirky. And for those of us here, I didn't know him, but it's a one degree of separation. It's a small town. And so I know tons of people who went to school with him and this and that. And, see him around all the time. There's sort of, he had just been at the record store and gone to a concert of somebody else. And so I think, huge amount of shock going on in Minneapolis. And, of course, I'm thrilled that they're turning the Paisley Palace into a museum, because it means I'll get more visitors here. And there's finally something to take tourists to, because mostly you just kind of go, you want to go to the park? I don't know. It's just a nice, you know, D.C., there's a million tourist attractions, but Minneapolis is a nice place to live, but not really a great tourist.
I will say, though, I do think it has revealed some interesting cultural and generational divides, because I definitely have seen, and I've heard from colleagues, you know, Gen Xers like me who got up and made a reference, and it was kind of like crickets at, you know, in their churches.
My kids were like, "Who's Prince?" I said, "Prince sang our wedding song, Diamonds and Pearls." And then there was somebody at youth group, one of our youth group leaders, we were talking about it, said, "Who's Prince?" And this was an older woman. So I was like, yeah, the Gen Xers are kind of stuck in the middle between people who genuinely maybe just, I don't even know what, how you cannot hear of Prince. And then, anyway, it was funny.
I said Paisley Palace, not Paisley Park, because there's a collective household here of young adults of color called Paisley Palace. And, you know, it's just the influence is multi-generational, but not all of them. I mean, my 19-year-old knew who Prince was, but was like, why are you making such a big deal out of this, you know?
I was glad that, you know, people are now learning more about him, mm-hmm. because of the fact that he said, when I worked at Children's Defense Fund with Marion Wright Edelman, he was one of the people who came and did a concert in D.C., and the funds went toward the Children's Defense Fund ministry. And afterwards, you know, I was just walking him to the after party that they were having. He was very quiet, you know, just very introverted. And he belonged to the union for over 40 years and was a great advocate for musicians' rights and everything, and did a lot for the working poor, but because of it being a Jehovah's Witness, they don't promote what they do. You know, so a lot of people have...
Susan, are you saying you met Prince and it took you like 10 minutes to tell us that you were talked to him and met him?
I'm sorry, it was in the 1990s, early
1990s.
Wow! I was hanging out with Prince one day.
Yeah.
I was talking with Prince.
Well, it wasn't just me. It was everybody who worked at the Children's Defense Fund who was at the fundraiser that day. He did the concert at Warner Theater, and he's just, you know, it was just a very humbling thing. Just, you know.
Yeah, I saw Van Jones did an interview about that. I didn't know that Jehovah's Witnesses, that they don't want it to be shared. They feel like that diminishes what they give. And then all kinds of people started saying that he had supported all kinds of causes for youth and Black Lives Matter and all kinds of different things that he's been, but super behind the scenes, and having not hung out with him, as Susan has, but just even from watching.
It was a mess, 20 minutes. But you know what, the thing that I did say Sunday too, I said, you know how on Saturday we always peek him out the blinds when somebody knocks on the door, we don't want any Jehovah's Witnesses coming. I said, if Prince was on my porch, I would let him come in. I could call him right
now. He really did do door knocking.
Ever.
It's amazing that both Michael Jackson and Prince were Jehovah's Witnesses.
Yes.
You know, and Janet Jackson is as well. You know, just the kind of...
he grew up Seventh-day Adventist, right? And then he converted to Jehovah's Witness.
That's how he was raised.
Seventh-day Adventist. Okay.
Quincy Adams was a Unitarian.
Well, okay.
We'll claim him.
I'll play hum a few bars and I'll see if I can remember them. He did not get down. That was part of the deal about John Quincy Adams, was that he was not, you know, exactly a fun guy.
But, you know, it's interesting, growing up Christian and growing up in the neighborhood of All Souls Church, I lived in walking distance of All Souls Church all my life. And I went to John Quincy Adams Elementary School, which is right not far from the church. And growing up here, and when I was in high school, African Liberation Support Committee was doing work anti-apartheid in South Africa. And Reverend David Eaton, who was pastoring All Souls from 1969 to 1992, in 73-74, he was the only, also was the only church in Washington that allowed the organizing against apartheid groups to meet in the church building. Mm. And so no matter what your faith was, as a person who lived in D.C., All Souls was sort of seen as everybody's church because Davy Eaton kind of opened it up to, it was an everybody's church. So it's not, a, you know, for a long, when I tell people, and they say, well, where are you serving, Newman? I'll say at Davy Eaton's church. And they go, oh, because if I say All Souls, they say All Souls. I said Davy Eaton's church. And the man's been dead years. But they go, oh, yes, at 16th and Harvard Street.
You see, my word.
Yeah, because it's because, of, you know, and I'll say I was tricked into coming into the UU church.
I want to really, oh, I tell really me how, hear how this so works.
Can, yeah, tell me how so I can trick others.
You know, it's a great tool.
How did it work? How did it happen?
The welcoming is a great tool of evangelism. You think you're being invited to do one thing, and then here you are 6 years later on a view on YouTube with Church of the Larger Fellowship. It's a wonderful thing. But no, as a native Washingtonian, grew up Baptist because my mother was Baptist. My father was Methodist, but he didn't go to church, so I went to church with Mom. And as I went, as a teenager, 15 years old, I felt called to the ministry and preached my initial sermon, was licensed in the Baptist church. But D.C. is a strange animal. When I went to seminary at Howard Divinity School, in 1979, and he had to do an internship. There's no pulpit open to a woman unless it's Women's Day. So 51 Sundays out the month, you cannot be in the pulpit. And needless to say, at my senior colloquy class, when there was this great bishop such and such talking to us graduating seniors about what churches expect from their pastors, and I raised my hand and I said, well, what are anything in specific when the pastor is a woman? And he looked at me like I had a unicorn's horn on. And he said, I didn't ask any questions like that because a woman can't lead worship and be in the pulpit. And being the this was 1979. No, it was my senior year. It was 1982, my senior year in seminary here in D.C. And I said, so what part of the liturgy do I need my penis? And then, you know, all the men in the room just fainted dead away. So I've always been the Christian minister that pushes the envelope. So I've always been on the edges. I'm the one talking about sexuality, don't HIV AIDS training and prevention in the early 80s. And so I was pastoring UCC Church in Atlanta, Georgia. Andy Young was one of my ministers on my staff. Very humbling thing. Mm-hmm. And my mother had a stroke, and I had to move back to D.C. in 2000 to take care of her. And so in the United Church of Christ, we have conferences like UU has districts. There were no churches open in my conference that I could apply for as a senior minister. So I started doing faith-based work like Children's Defense Fund, policy at Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice, where I met Meg. And so one Sunday, Reverend Hardy's in 2010, who I knew because I had worked as Mayor Anthony Williams' senior religious advisor, so I got to know Rob. He invited me to preach Neighborhood Justice Sunday at All Souls, and so after I preached both services, I got this roaring standing ovation, and Rob leaned over to me in the pulpit, and he said, I've been here 11 years, and I've gotten ovations, but nothing like that. When white people stand up in our church, they're going home. But I felt something. I felt a connection with the people, and it never really clicked in my head about that Unitarian churches were different than any other Christian church. It never really clicked because All Souls has always been that open and welcoming of all people. And so the next week, Rob called me at the Religious Coalition office and said, checking to see, did you get your honorarium check? And I said, yes, I did. And he was kind of hemming and hawing on the phone. And I thought maybe since marriage equality had just been signed into law in the pulpit that, in the sanctuary of the church, that maybe he needed help doing weddings. And I said, well, Rob, is there something you need? He said, well, you know, we know you have a full-time job, but we would pay you just to be in our pulpit on Sunday. And I said, well, what do you really need? Because Warren Buffett had just cut our budget, our grant, by half $1 million. And he said, we're looking for a settled associate, and we need a one-year interim. And we just would love if you would apply. So I applied, and so I said, okay, I'll come for 1 year. So I was committed to 1 year as Minister of Social Justice at All Souls. And here I am 6 years later acting senior minister.
That's amazing. That's amazing, and what a gift for all of us. I'm really curious, Susan, so you went from All Souls as your introduction to Unitarian Universalism. There must have been somewhat as a culture shock when you realized the wider whiteness and the, just the wider context of what you'd stepped into. Can you describe how that...
And it didn't hit me because of the fact that All Souls is, like, right now we're 80% white and 20% people of color and other ethnicities. And the music is such world religion. We have jazz, we have gospel, we have everything, you know. So it didn't start hitting me until one Sunday after I preached, I sang a song, a Mahalia Jackson song. And you would have thought I had just, sacrificed a cow up in the pulpit and poured the blood on the floor. I mean, and the thing is, I mean, because I, you know, you don't get, well, no, in a bad way, because, you know, it's sort of like, you know, in the black church, I'm used to talk back. You know, you're preaching in the black style of preaching folk and fine art. You know, amen, preach it, sister, come on now. You know, I'm used to a little talk back. But with All Souls, you get, you know, I have found in predominantly white denominations and settings, you get feedback. And even in some black, you know, high liturgical settings, they don't talk back, but you get the feedback. But all of a sudden, it was like a rat could have pissed on cotton. So deafening. And I think the song that I sang was a Mahalia Jackson song, I Found the Answer, I Learned to Pray. Mm. And the song says, keep your Bible with you, read it every day. Well, honey, I didn't know. So then I realized that it's sort of like during new members orientation over the months, I found out that a lot of the people who have come to the UU Church are what I call refugees from the Christian church of their birth or family of origin. There are a lot of people who were raised UU, but there are so many at All Souls who've come from the Catholic Church in particular, from Christian churches that they've had bad experiences. So they feel that the UU Church is sort of like the neutral zone in Star Trek. Mm-hmm. And so then here I come again. I decided to take a Star King Seminary class online about the history of liturgy and worship. And, you know, and I said, well, the Congregational Church, which is UCC, and the UU folk separated in 1815 over that little bitty issue about the Trinity, that little bitty issue of the Trinity. And so after a few months, when I decided I did want to consider applying as associate pastor, we went on a conference where large congregations that had 500 or more members gathered.
I remember seeing you there. It was here in St. Paul. Yep.
Yes, it was. And we went to Ella Isaac's church for one day with all of our staff, met with his staff. And then we went to the conference. And all of a sudden, 95% of the people were white, male, and over 60. And when the evening worship was held, there were women there, but not one woman led anything in the worship, not a prayer, not a scripture. They did have this one white, older white lady who made an announcement at the end of the service. And so all Rob Hardy's, Louise Green, all of Gabrielle Farrell, all the All Souls staff came running to me because they knew I was candidate. They said, please, please don't leave us. This is not how everything is. The whole church is not like this. So I just, you know, and again, and it's something I talk about now. I talk about know before you go. I just thought All Souls Church was all of the UU Church. And so that was like an awakening thing to me. And it's not like it was my first time being in a predominantly white setting because I'm UCC. Mm-hmm. But it was not just the racial makeup, but it was how Christianity was received. Me as and my first Sunday was the questions of faith. And when people just ask questions, because Rob just got back from vacation this August, and I said the first Sunday there that I was a flaming Christian. And I didn't know that that was going to be received in the way. And I think people thought I was like Jerry Falwell or Jonathan Whitfield, sinners in the hands of an angry God. That I was I'm the canary. I was willing to be the canary in the mine. If the UU Church wants to say I'm dedicated to being multicultural, multiracial, then I'm saying I am willing to help you do that. But then all of a sudden, as a canary in the mine, I found myself not singing.
Huh.
you see. So it wasn't all bad, but that was a cultural shock for me, Meg.
Oh, I'm sure it was. I mean, I've taken staff to GA, you know, African-American staff members who are in, I warn them, but there's something about the sea of it coming at you that I think you can't, it's sort of like you know someone's going to die and they die, you know, it's different. But it's going to be interesting this year at GA, you know, Black Lives UU is going to be more visible, and I'm just curious how that will go. I hope very well. But how's the Christianity, how's that evolved at All Souls?
Well, you know, what's interesting is that it took a period of time, and I guess it took a period of time of people getting to know me, to know what kind of Christian I was. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, here I am. I write books about sex being a wonderful thing and a gift from God, and that Jesus said, love your neighbor, not your neighborhood, you know. So I wrote a book called Oh God, A Black Woman's Guide to Sex and Spirituality. So again, like I said, I'm the Christian who's pushing the envelope on the Christian side. So I just knew, oh, I would fit in with the UU Church. I'm, you know, open, affirming. I perform weddings of same gender loving people. You know, I'm that person on the edge. But I think where I found it was when when I would preach and I would get emails or text messages from people before I could even get home. And it was not so much I said something, it was because of what I represented. They would project their fears and uncomfortableness. Mm-hmm. I was the memory of what they had left. And so I what I did is I started writing my prayers to make sure I didn't say, Lord Jesus, Master, let me walk with thee, Father God, in the name of Jesus, anything like that. I started writing my prayers every Sunday. And after service, there would be occasionally someone who would say, your prayers were just heavily Christian. And I said, what do you mean? And I would hand the prayer to them out of my worship book, and they would read it. It was just that the fact that they know I'm Christian, you see. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. And you know, Rob, trying to be helpful, Rob is like, well, you know, we love you, and so many people who love you, and just don't pay attention to that. And I'm thinking, I'm not bringing the ministry that I can bring to this congregation if I ignore this. Mm-hmm. You know, it is the elephant in the room. There are so many people who are Christian in the congregation, but they've been closeted because they didn't want to come out as. I found out there was a Christian UU fellowship.
Mm. And yes, there is.
Yeah, and I met them at the GA, and it was wonderful, you see. So it has been interesting. And then, of course,
I might, because this All Souls was the church I was going to my first year at seminary, which was a time for me. I grew up Catholic. It was a time for me in seminary of grappling with Christianity and what do I think about Jesus, which was both, and it was all mixed up in a lot of different things. But I realize now that, like, part of what I was picking up at All Souls and the general vibe was a certain allergy to Jesus that was happening. And when I moved back to Buffalo and started working with the Church of the Larger Fellowship, I kind of had space to re-embrace. I call myself Jesus inspired now.
Yeah.
So but that was a vibe I wasn't consciously picking up on at All Souls. Until we talked about it right now.
Except Jesus is in the music a lot at All Souls.
Oh yes.
But you can't say it. Yeah, it's very.
You can't say it, but you can sing it.
honestly, the most moving tenebrae service I've ever been in my 42 years of pastoral ministry was at All Souls, the first Good Friday. It was just so moving, and Christmas, and we outdo the Christian church at Christmas time. And I said one time at the JPD, Joseph Priestley District meeting, they asked Rob and I to be the keynoters to talk about how to draw and sustain diverse people in our congregations. And Rob spoke first, and then I got up and said, you know, it's sort of like inviting somebody to your house, but you don't ask them if they had any food allergies, and you don't ask them if they have any particular foods they like to eat, and you fix some of what you normally fix, and then fix some of what they fix. I said, I'm used to potluck being, you know, maybe some meat and some vegetables, some greens, and some macaroni and cheese. I said, potluck here was 37 kinds of hummus. What the hell? I never, hummus is something that you accidentally eat. I never, oh my God. And I said, and what is that thing? I said, quinoa. And they said, quinoa. I said, where I come from, Q-U-I-N-O-A is pronounced quinoa. And I was like, oh my God. It was just a culture shock. So, again, my thing is, and I say this to the UCC church, I just came back from a UCC Women Clergy Leadership, and they had various workshops about being women clergy, being parents, different things about leadership, retirement, and I said, can we talk about when you have a predominantly white church setting, and then you have leadership that are people of color, and how we should have some kind of competency classes to prepare the congregation for what it means to have someone who is not you or who is not white. And even when we have anti-racism workshops at various churches, UCC, UU, whatever, there are people who say, okay, I've had that class now. Like, I took the anti-racism class once, so I'm good. And then all of a sudden when white fragility shows up, they're like, what do you mean white fragility? So it's a lot of work to be done on all sides, and I think I'm just like, I'm just the intro to diversity 101 Christianity.
Well, I do wonder what it's like to all the different ways that you are a border crosser just by showing up for your job.
Yes. You know, honestly, I shared this with the congregation for the first time February. I said, when I have to preach, when I'm on the schedule to preach, I have to write 3 sermons in 1 week. I write the sermon the way the Spirit gives it to me. And then I edit the sermon for the Unitarian ear. And then I edit the sermon so I have a job after the benediction. You see?
Yeah, but that's
work. And so now, again, nobody has asked me to do that, but that is the feeling that I have. And so that particular Sunday, I said, I had talked to Queen of Boston, who works on the national staff, and she is a member of our church. I talked with Queen of Boston, Sharon Groves, who's a member of our church, used to be head of religious affairs at HRC. And I talked with Janice View, a lifelong African-American UU member of the church and trustee board chair. That 1 week we met, and I shared with them the burden on my heart about it, and they said, start preaching your first sermon. Don't be afraid to preach your first sermon. I preached my first sermon, and it was so powerful for the church and for me.
I'm so glad to hear that. It just broke my heart when you described that work, because we need the Spirit. So you did it multiple times, or?
Oh, I've done it. I've done it now about 3 times, and it's been it's wonderful. It is a wonderful feeling. It is a wonderful feeling, and I felt free enough the last 3 times I've preached. I've actually sang, and people have said they liked the song. They said, "Oh, we didn't know you really could sing," and they're more comfortable. But I think it's because they didn't know me. And again, I just represented a bad experience they'd had in a Christian church. Now, what has helped me is coming to Finding Your Way Home retreat, when the people, professionals of color gather and we share. And then when other white allies in the UU denomination that I've gotten to know through our Chesapeake UU Ministers Association meetings, even here in my own church, some of the folk who've been members of All Souls for years, how some of our senior citizens, silver souls of all races, they have taken time to talk with me, and it's not all the folk. It's just everybody's coming from a different place.
So Susan, you and I met in September because we're both part of a book compiled by the Ministers Association, the Committee on Anti-Racism and Multiculturalism. Right now it's a working title, but the title now is Making Visible the Invisible. And it was a really powerful gathering of UU ministers of color, and I think you were the only UCC minister who was there, right?
Who'll yes, be in the that's book. Right. That's
and
right.
It was, you know, we could talk a little bit about just maybe our chapters, but I'd love to hear about your chapter. And it was a really compelling experience being together, because a lot of people had a different version of the same story of how to bring our authentic self and yet keep a job after the benediction.
Right, right, exactly.
You know, people being uncomfortable, when people are pushed to discomfort to a certain point, I don't know that they care that you're, you know, one of very few people of color in this religion, in the profession. You're going to get fired. I mean, it's happened to ministers of color, religious education. I mean, I know it happens to ministers of any color, but it feels like we're saying we want to be something, and yet getting there takes effort and time. And anyway, so if you want to, if you're comfortable talking about maybe a little bit of your chapter, that would be great.
Yes, I would be glad to, Aisha. It was so healing just to be in a room of about maybe 15 or 18 UU professionals of color. We were Egyptian, Middle Eastern, Indian, Latino, you know, everything from the Caribbean. And one thing that I found interesting that all of us had in common as we were sharing our stories is that at some point at our churches, after we preached, there would have been a white person who would have come to us and said, "Did you write that by yourself?"
Oh,
all of us, all of us had that experience. And, you know, it just, I'm just like thinking, now here I have been preaching and teaching homiletics for 40 years. And, you know, so again, for me, it was a lot of the experiences. There were some times that I know there were persons that were not meaning to, but were being mean-spirited, but often people were not being mean-spirited. They just were not culturally sensitive to know how what they said to me would be received. One Sunday, I had just finished preaching two services. I was very tired, because you know how we do. We get up 5:30 in the morning, review our sermons, print it out, got to still get dressed, feed yourself, feed somebody else, get to the church, light the candles, all the stuff that you shouldn't have to do. And so after preaching twice in fellowship hall, I just wanted to get something to eat. And this senior white member, she came to me, very sweet lady, and she said, "Reverend Susan, can I ask you a question?" I said, "Yes." She said, "Titles are important to your people, aren't they?" And I'm thinking, I just want a damn cookie and some punch. And I don't want to have a Black History moment here. And I said, "Well, really, this is the first time in 42 years that I'm not called Dr. Newman. I'm either called Reverend Newman or Dr. Newman. And when I get here, people are calling me Susan." Mm-hmm. And what she was saying is, "Rob is Rob, Reverend Louise, Louise is Louise, but you want us to call you Reverend Susan." And I said, "Well, it's just that it's important. You know, I don't have the privilege to not be called by the title that I've earned. 4 years of college, 3 years of a master's degree program, and 3 years of a doctorate." I said, "And it also implies an intimacy that is not does not exist between us."
Mm-hmm.
I would never call my pastor David. He's Reverend Pastor Durham. You know, so that cultural thing again. Mm-hmm. And then she went further and asked, she said, "Is it because you all were called boy and girl for so long?" And I said, "No. It's because I'm the first person in my family to get a doctorate degree. For the first month after graduation, everybody in my family, no matter what you call me doctor. My mother called me Dr. Baby for 30 days. You know, so again, you know, the thing that I do like is that in the Unitarian Church and other predominantly white denominations, that there are white people who are in touch with white privilege, who are striving to be white allies, to be sensitive to cultural things, and want to learn and teach that. And the thing is, it has to come from, it can't just be me and other people of color always being the one saying this. You know, so I think it's wonderful. Like, we now have Reverend Rob Keithen, who's an affiliated minister of All Souls. Rob is teaching an adult spiritual development class on how to be a white ally. And I think it's a wonderful thing. So that was just one of the experiences that I had that is just, it just, you know, I was tired. It just took me by surprise. And then you just go, oh, one day. But now this was a funny experience I did have, though. It was the Sunday the church was going to vote for me as the candidate. And after service, a man came up to me and said, well, I'm an atheist, and I don't believe in anything about a God or anything. And if we call you as our minister, as a Christian, what would you have for people like me? And I said, well, you know, I'm a good cook, and I see you standing before me hungry, saying that you're hungry. And if you tell me what you have a taste for and are willing to get in the kitchen with me, I'll be willing to help make something. I said, but answer a question for me. As an atheist, why would you come to something called a church on Sunday morning? I would be at the Marriott drinking mimosas, having a good old time with my friends, instead of sitting up in the church. And I said, and then you get upset if I say the word God or Holy One in my prayer or sermon. That's like going to the circus and getting pissed when a clown come out. It's a circus. I said, we're a Unitarian church, not a Noetarian church, you see.
Boy, we are so uncomfortable with theological diversity, even though that's supposedly what we're about.
But it's worse than that. It's, you know, my husband's, it's worse than being uncomfortable with theological diversity. Susan, what you just said, you hit the nail on the head. We gather on Sunday mornings. We're very Protestant in how we operate, but yet we have people coming to church and not wanting to hear the word God. You know, my husband at one point said to me, why don't Unitarians just become a country club, because that's what you are? Why are we even pretending to be a religion? You know, and I'm like, no, I'm trying to help change it. But that's the worst part for me. It's like, pick one. Just be what you want to be, but don't go to a church called All Souls and then ask that no mention of God or anything happen. That's the, that gets my goat, you know, a lot.
Well, what was your chapter about, Asian? Oh, sorry, Joanna. I want to hear what your chapter was about, Asia.
Natalie Fenimore, Reverend Natalie Fenimore of Shelter Rock, and I are writing about religious education and being religious educators of color in a congregation. So we have a couple of layers of that because we're not, well, Natalie is a minister. She was a religious educator for 14 years before she became a minister, and I'm not a minister. And so we talk about the role, how religious education is seen, the religious educator who's always never, you know, seen as high as a minister, and because our diversity, and I still think this is true, is mostly in RE through multicultural adoptions, interracial adoptions. So we talk about that, those dynamics.
And we have that too. That's the thing that is so powerful. We have a lot of white families that have adopted children of color at All Souls, and our RE department, our RE program is so great. Children are learning different values. They learn about different religions. They even learn about Jesus. They learn about Buddha, world stories, and through our story for all ages. So our children, you know, are getting it. And I just think, you know, when you have a congregation of 1,300 members, 964 active, but then when you have a church meeting, it's about 250 people show up, and you know there are those people who come all of churches, no matter what size they are. There are those people who come on Sunday only, and they're not in whether covenant groups where you get to hear different religions and appreciate and get to talk. But that's what you try to push. You keep the dialogue going, and you keep it before everyone. Now, we're great on social justice issues. Great. I mean, we were there. We had Dr. William Barber preach for us in March. We were at Democracy Spring, Democracy Awakening. Over 2,000 folk were arrested about voter suppression and money in politics. There were UUs from all over the country. 25 All Souls members alone got arrested in civil disobedience. So all of us are at different places, and we're still learning. We're still striving. And I'm just saying that when I'm no longer at All Souls and someone else comes, I think because of just me being there, the number of years that I would be there, that would make a difference for another person who may be Christian who comes after me, you see. And even now there is a Through the Bible survey class, ASD class, finally. I think it's wonderful. Gabrielle Farrell, who was our DRE at the time when I first came, had me offer a class on a survey of Old and New Testament, and nobody registered for it. We offered it twice, nobody registered for it. And so now 6 years later, it's that's a, of course being offered, and members of the church are doing it together, and folk are coming. So it's, you know, it takes time.
I love that story. Three times is the charm.
Yeah.
I gotta say that, yeah, like that is massively countercultural for that church. I really love that.
Well, it's interesting to me that
when did that start?
Okay, three of us are trying to talk at once. I'll step back.
Okay, now somebody has to talk, right? when did that start at All Souls? I mean, when did it become so, you know, kind of, that wasn't David Eaton, was it? I mean, when did this kind of, or is it really, is it really just a 5%?
I don't think it's worse at All Souls than almost any of our churches. I don't want to make
really?
It on All Souls. Right, no.
Exactly. No, it's not just All Souls.
This is, All Souls is, a lot of churches won't even sing about Jesus. Like, I mean, no, I think All Souls is less hostile to Christianity than a bunch of other churches, including a bunch of other Beltway churches.
Exactly. Mm. It's just that All Souls happens just to be the first UU church that I've gone to and been on the staff, you see. You know, David Eaton was United Methodist minister when he was called to be the pastor of All Souls. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, you become sensitive. Now that I've been at All Souls, I've become sensitive to what the culture is. So when I do my prayers, I'll say, Spirit of Life, God of many names. You know, I know Spirit of Life is a safe thing to say. When I visit people on doing pastoral care visits, I'll ask them, what is your spiritual faith? What is your belief? What is your spiritual practice? Because before, and I'll even ask, do you mind if I pray with you?
Mm-hmm.
And people will let me know whether or not they're humanist, agnostic, or, you know, or what, you know. So I'm learning to be sensitive to that as well.
I thought, for me, part of the problem. Joanna, you've been trying to get in for a while. I'll back up. Come on. Meg, after this. There is this really interesting sort of dynamic, though, about people expecting to get only what they want. I went to the seminary that I went to. I actually went to. I'm a cradle UU, but I went to an evangelical seminary, and the majority of my classmates were AME or National Baptist, and they were so much better at using their universal theological translator. You know, if I preached in chapel, I wouldn't say Jesus, but they would project that because that was what would feed them. Like they didn't need me to actually use their preferred terms. They could put it in. And this is a big question for me, and I use, it's a Star Trek term, universal translator. I'm always trying to hit that, we're the ones with it, you know, use your translator. But I do think that there are some kind of weird entitlement issues embedded in all of this.
Say more, would you? Who's entitled?
Well, and that's the question, is the people who are coming to church who are saying, this is what I expect to receive. Mm. You know, I do not want to hear these words. I do not want to hear this. It needs to fit within this box. And so it was very interesting for me as a UU in this Christian, pretty conservative Christian world, of seeing people who just, like, that would not have even entered their mind. They, you know, because God is with them, and so they don't need me to be labeling it. They can provide that themselves.
Well, the other part is that, you know, the belief that church is going to be a friendly, supportive, non-challenging place to go, that you go to church to be affirmed in your beliefs. Well, you know, I mean, that's a pretty limited definition of what the church is supposed to be. I mean, you're supposed to go to, I mean, the standard is you go to church because you're a sinner and you expect to hear about it. on Sunday so that you can do something about it. It's not like you go to church because you're a sinner and the pastor says, well, that's all right. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like,
now that's,
you know, what, I mean, church is supposed to be challenging, right? I mean, that's...
Right. One of my lines is, you know, why are you expecting church to be comfortable? You have confused church with a warm bath.
Yeah, you know, it's like... And, you know, I mean, that's the shadow side of Congregationalism, you know, is that, you know, I went to a Methodist seminary. I was born at UU, too, and I went to a Methodist seminary, and one of my students says, well, in a congregational structure, whatever stops you from preaching whatever people want to hear? And I said, you know, I was snarky about it. I mean, it's a hard question. I said it was the same thing that stops Methodists from preaching what the bishop wants to hear. But, you know, either you have integrity or you don't. But that is the shadow side of Congregationalism, is that they're grading you out there as to whether or not you make them happy. And so it feeds a consumerism and entitlement, you know. And the allergy to Christianity, which comes, I think, from a specific time and place in American history, and I think is fading away, though our entitlement and consumerism keeps going on in other forms. But that's still that same, you know, I got to tell you, my dad lost his, you know, was fired from his last church. And in Youngstown, Ohio, this was way big on it a long time ago. And numbers on, there were people who were keeping in their order of service the number of religious references they found offensive in his services. Meg, go ahead.
I just wanted to say how much it is easier for those of us who are white to point out entitlement than for people of color to do it. I mean, and especially those of us who grew up in this movement and who say it from within. And I just see this really different reaction when my colleagues of color have lifted up the same things that Joanna and Tom just said. I just want to name that because there is incredible entitlement woven through so many aspects of our congregational life, and white fragility has it respond really differently when white people say it, when people of color say it. I feel like, you know, I also grew up UU, interestingly, three of us here, and I went to a UCC seminary, what was then and is not now, with great excitement, I say, very white UCC seminary. And it wasn't until I interned in a black church that really used black it was a multiracial church, but the minister preached black liberation theology, that I said, I don't even know this Bible. I don't even know this Jesus. I don't even know this God. And I think... so many, and I had been, you know, in the lesbian community, a lot of white lesbians before going, you know, to Boston and interning there, and I remember this huge fight that happened around some white lesbians talking about Jesus as another white guy and some black lesbians getting really mad about that, and I had gotten it that it was wrong, but I hadn't really understood, like, how wrong it was. And so part of it is that the God that people have rejected has nothing to do with the God of black liberation theology. It's an oppressive God. And so it's, I mean, we all get into that, the God you don't believe in, I probably don't believe in either. But I think when we're crossing cultural and theological lines, it's so hard, because if I hadn't been kind of the white person thrown into that, I don't know that I would have gotten it, because it took me months to get it, and I would have left if I didn't need the credit, because it was terrifying. And so how do we build theological literacy, Susan? I'm curious, because sounds like you've been all over the place. I mean, I don't mean theologically, but I mean the communities that you've served, you've been all over the place.
Yeah, because, you know, I have been in ecumenical settings, you know, studied theology at the Ecumenical Institute in Geneva, Switzerland, have done this in Africa. And I guess that's why I take it. And I come from a United Methodist background. My grandfather is United Methodist. My six uncles, one was a bishop in the United Methodist Church, one a district superintendent, My father was the only child that was not a preacher. He was the black sheep of the family. That's why I didn't grow up United Methodist. But so what I do, I always encourage people to find the common ground. You know, every the ministers of the church, we each have a Sunday off each month. Rob and I, we each have a Sunday off. And on my Sunday off, I go worship at my home church, which is Covenant Baptist United Church of Christ. Dennis and Christine Wiley are the co-pastors. And we are a very progressive church. They're the church. They changed the church's constitution to perform same-gender loving weddings. We lost half of the membership, but we've gained new people back. So I've always been a part of progressive Christian faith and working with people of all faiths, you see. As a senior advisor to the mayor, my interfaith council, we had people who were everything. And I just tried to find the common ground of what it is that we share together. And everybody has in, I said there's nothing, the seven principles of the UU Church are in total harmony of Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. If you want to find common ground, you can find it. But if you want to be just that type of person that wants to be calcitrant, you will. You will not find it. You want to argue, that's fine. I will not contribute to that. You see, I will try to find the common ground and see what is it that we can do together that would improve the life of people around us. Because while we're bickering over whether or not Jesus was the Son of God and rose on the third day, people are still being murdered by the minutes. You see what I'm saying? We're still at war. We still have people running for office that we're not too sure about. So I just, again, I love doing, and see, for me, you know, as James Cone talked about Jesus being, you know, the God of the oppressed, I don't have, you know, the God that I serve is the God that cares about people being murdered, cares about war, cares about people not having a living wage and affordable housing. So those are the things that I try to find common ground on and lift those up. And I meet people where they are. If you were at the well, Jesus is going to ask you for a glass of water so that he can get in your business and change your life, you know? So that's just what I just do the ministry of what helps and uplifts people. And when I get an opportunity to be in dialogues like this and at GA, when we have those rooms we go in that we can feel safe and comfortable to air our messages, Dr. Yolanda Pierce, African-American Studies professor at Princeton Theological Seminary, after Ferguson, when she wrote that litany, and she said, "Let us not rush to the language of healing until we have fully understood the depth of the injury." And that is something that still comes to us as people of various races, is that when we, in order to become the beloved community, we have to be willing to live with each other and to deal with the messiness and not wear our feelings so much on top of our skin. And so that was something I had to learn to do. And I have to love you enough that I'm going to tell you, when you say this and do this, this is how it makes me feel. Now, what can we do to change things together, we say.
Well, I wish I were still in D.C. to come and hear you. It's really so exciting to hear about your ministry there. And
Thank you.
It's a great church, and thanks for serving it. For serving
what I'm looking
movement.
For, I'll be at GA June through Monday through Friday or Monday through Saturday, so I look forward to hopefully seeing you all.
Yes,
you there.
Oh, that's great. Yes, so we're coming to the end of our hour. Susan, is there anything you didn't get to say that you wish we'd asked or that you've gotten to say?
Well, no, I just thank you for this opportunity, for asking me to come on and to talk about my experiences as a UCC minister in a UU church. And I'm always hopeful. And, you know, the thing is, for every a challenging experience I've had 10 wonderful ones. So, you know, this is how we learn. And I thank you very much for inviting me to be a part of this dialogue.
Thank you so much.
So, and thanks for Aisha. This was your great idea. What a good one.
Thank you.
So next week is May, and we have the first week in May, May 5th, we have a double hitter. We have, at our usual time, we'll have representatives from TRUST, the Transgender Religious UU Professionals Group. And I don't know what the T stands for at the end of trust. But anyway, it's Transgender Religious UU Professionals coming at the usual time. And then at 5 o'clock Eastern, Bob and Tom and Hank will be at a summit on the sustainability of ministry. And so there will be and a bonus show that people can
live
come to both.
Live from the UUA.
So that's live from the UUA. They'll be talking to all kinds of people who are there talking about money and ministry, a really important subject.
This has been a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find out more about the CLF, visit questformeaning.org.